This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Nobody was quite expecting the state of Georgia to become a crucible of politics in America. But a major organizing effort by Democrats gave Georgia to Biden, the first time for a Democratic presidential candidate since 1992. Now both of Georgia's Senate seats are up for grabs in runoff races in January. The stakes could not be higher. These two seats will determine the balance of power in the Senate, and that, of course, will be critical to what the Biden administration can and cannot achieve.
It's a new adventure here every day in Georgia.
Did you think that Georgia become the center of the political universe?
No, not really.
Staff writer Charles Bethay is based in Atlanta, and he's been reporting on all of this for many months. A lot of people, Biden and Trump supporters alike, spent the days after Election Day sweating out the results in Georgia, Charles. And I've got to say that at least on Twitter, you were calling it for Biden really early. Where did that confidence in Biden terms come from?
Well, I mean, you know, before the election, I felt like demographic shifts and voter registration drives and concern about Trump's handling of the pandemic was going to benefit Biden quite a bit. But, you know, on the day of the election and the days following, I knew certain counties, especially a few north of Atlanta, Cobb County, Gwinnett County, DeKalb County, that these Democrat-leaning counties were going to potentially be late reporting their returns. And also on Election Day, there was a pipe that burst in Fulton County, which is a very Democrat-leaning county. That delayed things there. So I was pretty confident that while Trump got out to a lead, Biden was going to make up most of that as returns came in.
So Joe Biden is the first Democratic presidential candidate to win in Georgia for nearly 30 years. And yet as recently as the 2018 midterms, we saw just how hard it is for a Democrat to get elected there statewide. Stacey Abrams lost the governor's race by 50,000 votes, and there were accusations of voter suppression. What just changed to give the state to Biden?
Well, first of all, the 50,000 or so vote margin that separated Stacey Abrams from Brian Kemp, who became governor, is about how much Democrats have been gaining on Republicans every 2 years or so over the last decade. So there was an expectation there that alone would lead to a very close election. Also, you know, there have been lots of efforts to register voters, some of them led by Stacey Abrams and a group she founded called the New Georgia Project. And I actually spoke with Nse Ufot, the CEO of the New Georgia Project, about these efforts.
I mean, many people have written and talked about the changing demographics in Georgia. Georgia is going to be the first state in the Deep South with a white minority. So up to this point, we've registered 500,000 people to vote. Most of them people of color. And we saw that Biden won Georgia with 29% of the white vote. Biden got 29% of the white vote in our state. And so, like, yay, I suppose. But Republicans, white conservatives in Georgia have purged people from the voter rolls, right? Subjected Black voters to intimidation. Black voters and Latino voters are the number one targets of misinformation and disinformation campaigns. And we're in the middle of a pandemic, and cops keep shooting Black people and with no accountability, and they still showed up and voted for Biden. So when we talk about what it took to get here in Georgia, it is very on brand to center white suburban women. But that is only a part of the story. Because again, Trump won 71% of white voters in Georgia, and Biden still pulled it up.
So you've got two Senate races that are heading toward runoff elections. And these are going to be hugely consequential for the whole nation, for the whole balance of power in this country. So just to get some facts straight here, states don't usually elect both of their senators at once, do they? Why is that happening now?
Right. So one of them is David Perdue's seat is up for re-election, and that's normal. But the other is a result of Republican Senator Johnny Isaacson retiring due to illness, and his seat being briefly filled by Kelly Loeffler by appointment by Governor Kemp. And there was a special election that fielded something like 20 candidates. And the result of that was Loeffler ending up in a runoff with Raphael Warnock, the Democrat.
Now, how do you expect the dynamics of the Senate races to be different in any way from the presidential race between Trump and Biden?
I mean, conventional wisdom and history show that runoffs don't really draw a lot of voters, and those that they draw tend to be hyper-partisan and highly motivated. But in this case, control of the Senate's at play, as we said. There's a huge amount of interest outside of Georgia. There's a lot of money coming in. There's Andrew Yang has moved here or is moving here. We've already seen Rubio and Rick Scott come here to stump. When I talked to Nse Ufot from the New Georgia Project, she also brought up the unique racial and age dynamics of the runoffs that could potentially help Democrats more than Republicans.
80-year-old Biden up against 80-year-old Trump doesn't feel like the same sort of research scenario for a Raphael Warnock versus Kelly Loeffler. For a number of reasons, race, gender, name recognition. I think that there's a sort of authoritarian draw, the strongman draw that people are attracted to, that we just don't see with Kelly Loeffler. And Warnock's also a Black man, right? Thinking about Warnock as only the third person to ever command Dr. King's pulpit since he was murdered. That means something. That means something not only in Atlanta, but it means something in Black pockets all across the state. Thinking about Warnock and Ossoff as they've run together, they've messaged together, they've done ads together, they came out with Barack Obama together, President-elect Biden, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's exciting to see what is possible. I think that if anything, their audiences, their bases, if you will bleed over to one another, that the white suburban moms of Atlanta who ride for John Ossoff will get introduced to Warnock, this Black pastor from the historic Ebenezer Baptist Church. And so Warnock campaigning with Ossoff absolutely lends credibility to Ossoff that he could not buy.
Ufot mentioned Democratic pockets outside of Atlanta. Now, on the map of the presidential election, Georgia looks like a lot of other states with deep blue cities and a whole lot of red elsewhere. Are the small towns and rural areas actually in play for Democrats? I mean, outside of Atlanta, Augusta, and Savannah?
Well, to be sure, the greater Atlanta area is where the Democrat base lives. But rural Georgia is not just white. It's not just Republican, even if it leans that way. There are a lot of rural Black communities. I actually drove down to visit one of those communities a few hours south of Atlanta recently to meet with a guy named Royce Reeves, who's a city commissioner in a town called Cordele.
It's watermelon capital of the world, of course. Supposedly produce and ship out more watermelons than any other place in the world. And I don't, you know, I rally the watermelon. We ate so many of them coming up. You know, it was like.
So Cordele's a small town. There's something like 12,000 people there. But even here in rural Georgia, Reeves has seen a demographic shift.
The railroad tracks used to separate the races. The African Americans are on the west side of the tracks, and white America is on the east side of town. But like I say, you know, people done better, so they did better. And you know, because they did better, they was able to afford homes. And I expect in the next 10, 15 years, you know, there will be no what was affectionately known as the white side and the black side. Those days are vanishing fast. We have a majority African American population, like 65-70%. First time as of 3 years ago, we had our first majority African American board with the election of the first African American chair here in Cordele, Georgia. Our county.
So like a possibly surprising number of black men, Reeves did support Trump in 2016, but he did also quickly grow disillusioned with him.
He lost it with me with the way he handled the Congressman Lewis situation. Just totally embarrassing. He was just like, you know, it was like in your face, you know, I don't give a damn about you. And it's, you know, we can't, you know, moving forward, you know, we can't so far.
You were attracted to him in 2000.
So I met Royce in 2018 after his disillusionment had really taken hold. He was getting out the vote at the time for Stacey Abrams, and he was doing it in kind of a dramatic way, as is his sort of way of doing most things. He'd borrowed a funeral limo, and he was driving around town, and he was basically yelling out the window at folks that he saw. I mean, and he was trying to get him to go vote, and he was really good at speaking their language. I think he has kind of a gift at that.
Being in this community all of my life, being a barber, being in the business I've been in, you know, you got to know how to talk to people. You got to know who you're talking to. You can't just show up because it's vote time and asking somebody to vote for someone that you feel like we're going to do us good. I mean, because the senses of most people is, you know, I don't give a fuck. You know, I don't, you know, fuck Biden and Trump. You know, you get that sometimes. So, you know, it's difficult at times. But like I said, for the most of it here, after years of doing it, you know, when they see you coming up and they know it's an election, they're like, oh, I already know. I'm getting in. And so that was just one of the things. We're blessed with that here.
And so I want to talk about what you're thinking about the upcoming Senate runoffs. I've been talking to people, political scientists and experts on elections and runoffs, who say that it's very hard to get people to come out in runoffs, especially around the holidays. So what do you...
But Donald Trump, you have to look at these things from a different side. With Donald Trump refusing to acknowledge that Biden and Harris has won, people are still interested. They're still watching. You're correct. Normally, people wouldn't come back out to vote. I just don't see that happening this time. The people that came out to vote in the presidential election, they're coming back to vote here in Georgia for those two seats.
And how are you going to be involved in helping them make sure they come back? What are you planning to do this time?
I'm going to be involved on social media. I'll be sending out letters to churches, motorcycle clubs, different. I have a mask on with my Lysol, and I'll be pulling up in my truck, you know, asking people if they need a ride. We'll have a box of masks, some hand sanitizer, and we're going to do what we can do to get people to the polls, as we've always done.
Charles, all of this gets down to the question of the future in the state of Georgia. Has Georgia flipped over to the blue side? What's your read on that?
I mean, we have to remember that Biden, at the end of the day, won Georgia by 13,000 or 14,000 votes. Trump won, by comparison, Georgia in 2016 by a few hundred thousand votes. So, you know, if Biden had done that, sure, we could, I think, reasonably say that Georgia's blue. But given how tight it was, and given that David Perdue actually was something like 90 or 100,000 votes ahead of Ossoff before their runoff, it's a battleground state, and it's if we have to assign a color to it, it should be like a lavender or a periwinkle or something. The key for each side moving into future elections is going to continue to more and more be about getting out the vote. And so that's where somebody like NSEU fought, and the New Georgia Project is going to really continue to play a critical role.
Elections are determined. Election results, outcomes are determined by who shows up and whose votes get counted. And for a very long time, there was a lack of investment in turning out Black voters. And there is a long and recent history of voter suppression. And so the work of the New Georgia Project, the work of Leader Abrams, the work of Fair Fight, and a lot of people who are in our ecosystem have helped address those two issues. One, who shows up, and two, whose votes get counted. That's going to play out over and over and over again until Georgia gets an identity.
NSEU Fought is the CEO of the New Georgia Project. We also heard from Royce Reeves Sr., a city commissioner in Cordele. Charles Bethay is a staff writer. Charles, thanks so much for all your reporting during this long election season.
No problem. Thanks, David.
You can read Charles's article on the Senate runoff election at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Alexandra Schwartz writes for the New Yorker about theater, books, art, and much more. And recently, she's been raving about a debut novel by a writer named Sanaï Lemoine. Lemoine was born in Paris, but she lives in the U.S., and she wrote her novel in English. Lemoine's book is called The Margot Affair, and it draws on her life in a very particular way. Here's Alexandra Schwartz.
So The Margot Affair is narrated by Margot, who is a 17-year-old high school student in Paris. She lives with her mother, Anouk, who is a famous stage actress, a very dramatic figure and a dominant figure in her own life. And her father is the French Minister of Culture. The catch is that Margot's parents are not together. She and her mother are her father's secret family. He lives with his wife, who is a woman named Madame Lapierre, and their two sons, and they don't know anything about Margot's existence. And that is what starts to make Margot very uncomfortable the older she gets.
On any given day, ours could feel like an ordinary life. Like most families, we sometimes ate our meals in silence. We had been sick and torn up in each other's presence. I was often in a bad mood around Father, wanting more of him, but then I would disappear after we had finished eating, preferring to read or be alone. And then there was the banality of waiting. Weeks going by, waiting for him, hating him for being gone, wondering if he loved us, missing him, believing he was better than everyone else because time with him was precious. That is how we lived in a constant state of anticipation. On mornings when Anouk slept in, I stood on our balcony and looked down at the street. The pavement was so far away that I could no longer see any cracks. I watched people trotting down our street without ever raising their heads. I imagined hundreds of men and women who shared their lives with two partners. There were so many of us, children of these double families who dreamed of the other side. That night, like all the others since seeing Madame Lapierre, I awoke with the skin of my body chilled and wet, and a strong desire to tumble to the other side, to have the separate spheres of our lives collide. I lay paralyzed in bed with the desire to break free from this routine. I felt it pumping through me, wild and exciting.
So you discovered when you were a teenager, I believe, that your father also had a second family. What was it like to discover that?
It was really surprising. I discovered that my father had a second family, a woman he'd been seeing for several years, and two sons when I was 21. So I had just graduated from college. And I was in Paris for the summer, and I was living with my father. It was just the two of us. I truly did not suspect that there was another family. And so when he told me at first, I remember hearing his voice saying the words, and they didn't really register. And then all of a sudden, he had pulled out photos of them, and it happened kind of like in a dream. And I think because it was just the two of us at home, and I wasn't really telling anyone else about this other family at that stage, I often obsessed and thought about the other side and what their lives might be like.
And did you realize pretty early on that you were going to turn to fiction as a way of exploring that idea of the other side? Because the novel is told from the perspective of a narrator who had the opposite experience from you. She always knew that she was not her father's primary family. She understood that she was being kept a secret.
Yes. No, that's a great question. And no, I had no idea. So at that point, I was writing a lot, and I moved to New York after that summer to start my MFA at Columbia. I started writing this story that circled around a character named Margot, who was the hidden daughter of the Minister of Culture in France. And it took a while for me to see how, you know, that maybe there was this active, now that I look at it, maybe an act of empathy or like me trying to understand the psychology of what it would have been like for a hidden child. And also, what if she chose to break free from that secret, her father's secret?
Yeah, it's very interesting what you say about the secrecy element of it. In your novel, the plot is really set into motion when Margot decides that she's had enough of the secrecy. In what is a bit of an act of touching naivete, but also a very powerful act, she contacts a journalist and decides to reveal her father's identity. Your own father, I believe, asked you to keep his second family secret from your mother. So was that aspect of secrecy something that was on your mind as you were working through the novel?
Yes, it really was. And even that plot point took a long time for me to come to. And I think it's because it was so wrapped up with, maybe that was the most personal element of the story in a sense, because for, I think it was maybe about 2 months, I didn't talk to my mother about what I'd learned from my father, which, you know, 2 months isn't that long, but it feels like a lifetime in the moment. And so it took maybe 4 years of writing this novel to realize that Margot should be the one who breaks a secret. Early on, I had other characters, or it just appeared in the news. And I wonder, you know, in a sense, it's kind of a rewriting of history, of if if I had maybe had more awareness at the time or a better sense of my agency or maybe a less complicated or challenging relationship with both my parents, it wouldn't have stayed a secret from my mother for as long as it did.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's more than just personal precedent for the story. In thinking about this, I thought, people have second families everywhere. It's not just a French thing. But I think we in the United States tend to think of this tolerance for infidelity, for affairs, for other relationships as very French. And there is the major and probably most famous example of precedent in François Mitterrand's daughter, Mazarine, who was his daughter with his longtime lover, and who was kept secret from the public. I think her identity was revealed around her 20th birthday. Was that an event that you remember from your own childhood?
Yes, it's always been floating in the back of my mind. And around the time when I learned that my father had another family, I was working as a researcher for a journalist, an American journalist who lives in France. And one of my assignments was to study Mazarine Pinjot. And I read her autobiographical book. She's written several books, but one of her books, Bouche Cousue, is about her father. And I remember it was the first time that I really was discovering these very intimate details about their life behind closed doors. And I was so moved by it and how much love there was. And so I think it was more that I drew inspiration from there, perhaps, and thinking about my own relationship with my father and this sense of yearning that Margot has for her father in the novel. Really, what she's seeking for is not just his legal recognition as her daughter, but his love.
So the Margot affair is a very French novel in both its subject. It takes place in France. You have a minister of culture. You have the French lycée. You wrote about this and this very French world in English. Why do you write in English?
The short answer is that English is the language that I'm most comfortable in. It's the language that I learned to write and read in because we moved to Australia when I was 4. So although I first learned to speak in French and in Spanish with my mom, I fell in love with books in English. And French was really the language of writing essays for me and not so much creatively. So I wrote it that way, not thinking too much about it during the process. Though as I got closer to completing the novel, there were moments where I really worried that maybe this novel wouldn't be French enough, or it would be, I don't know, there would be something that would be missing from it because it was a story being told in English. And so I would play around with dialogue and I would even translate the English dialogue into French in my head and think, okay, is that really the choice of word, or is that the way that someone would have this conversation in French? And then I tried to find a middle ground because I didn't want the novel to feel like a translation. I wanted it to feel fluid and true to the English language.
I wasn't planning to ask this question, but now I actually really want to know. It is a coming-of-age novel. It's an unusual coming of age, but there are other things that many of us will relate to, trying to form your own identity, going out into the world on your own. There is sex. What was it like to write sex?
You are the first person to ask any question related to sex for this novel.
How is that possible?
It is
a sexy novel. There is, let's just say for listeners, without giving anything away, that there is a lot of sexual tension that courses through the novel. You have a young girl who is talking to an older male journalist who she's putting her hopes and dreams in his hands.
Sex is always difficult to write about. For this novel, it was kind of fun because Margot is 17. I wanted her experiences to be really heightened. And there's one scene, I guess, two-thirds of the way into the novel that I think of as a pivotal scene that is a sex scene. And that one was tough. I rewrote it several times. I wanted to convey that at 17, although Margot has had sexual experiences, she's thinking so much about the other person's pleasure and not about her own as well. And it's something that several readers have privately commented on, of this sense of recognition of, oh, I remember being at that stage where you are, oh, this is so intimate, but you're still defining yourself. Like you don't have a strong sense of self and identity yet, but you want to seem as though you do. So you're very much thinking about the other person and how you appear to them.
Yeah, a desire to project a certain kind of sophistication, which actually in itself is paradoxically kind of naive. You know, it seems like one of the big challenges in writing about sex also is that the acts themselves could not be more common. I mean, this is universal experience we're dealing with. And yet, for every person and for every character, the first time, these feelings are so new and explosive that you basically have to deal with something very familiar, but at the same time make it totally new from this person's perspective.
That's so true. And how do you do that in a way that is also sexy? And because I really wanted the sex to feel sexy, and I'm not just the sex, but the moments of attraction, the moments of sensuality. And I think, you know, we see a lot of uncomfortable sex or painful sex, and that's not what I wanted in this novel. I wanted it to be kind of this, in a year that is so difficult for Margot, where there is grief and there are moments of like real upheaval, that it can be something that is a pleasurable moment for her.
The book is dedicated to your mother and to your father, which just reading it on the dedication page before opening the novel and starting to read seems a lot simpler than it does by the end of the novel. Have your parents read the book, and what have they thought, if so?
Yeah, they've both read the book. My father read it first, and he didn't say much aside from, oh, I really loved the detail of the fact that the father character wears an white apron the way that I do, or, you know, that was kind of like the thing that he fixated on. But then something funny happened where a couple of weeks after the book was published, I got a call from my dad, and we were speaking on the phone, and we started talking about his family and how it had been really painful to learn about their existence. And he apologized for the first time in 10 years. I had always been waiting for him to say that he was sorry. And I sometimes wonder if that conversation wouldn't have happened without this book. And I feel like I need to say that, you know, as much as this novel is so personal, we've been talking about all the ways that it is, the parallels aren't necessarily clear. If you know my parents but don't know what happened, you would not necessarily recognize any of what is happening. There's a part of me that wondered, maybe my family won't see themselves in it. But of course they did see themselves.
Well, Sanai, thank you so much, and congratulations on a wonderful novel.
Thank you. Thank you, Alexandra, for this conversation.
Sanai Lemoine spoke with staff writer Alex Schwartz. Lemoine's novel is called The Margot Affair. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Remember the election of 1980. Ronald Reagan's opponents made a lot of his age. At 69, Reagan ended up being the oldest president ever elected. This month, a 74-year-old incumbent was defeated by a 77-year-old challenger whose main opponent in the primaries had been 78. And yet the age of the candidates was certainly not the most remarkable thing about this election. That's true at least in part because the country as a whole is getting older. The median age has gone up by about 8 years since Reagan's time. And in another 40 years, it's estimated that nearly a quarter of all Americans will be of retirement age. Staff writer Adam Gopnik reported for The New Yorker in 2019 on how we're preparing or not preparing to live in an aging society. Here's Adam.
Last August, two things happened to me. I turned 63, and so I decided to write something about aging. Now, I don't think of myself as old, but one of the things I discovered when I started reporting this piece is that no one thinks of himself or herself as old. We will all reject the label of being old no matter what it costs us in convenience. If you have a device that is especially helpful to the elderly, one thing you can be sure of is that no elderly person will ever buy it. That's the paradox of aging, which governs the whole realm of geriatrics. A couple of months ago, I went to visit the group of people who, perhaps more than anyone else in America, are spending all their time thinking about aging. They are software engineers, urban planners, public health researchers, just a whole slew of specialists who work together at this center in Cambridge, Massachusetts, called the MIT Age Lab.
The feel, the vibe of this place is very sort of, you know, George Jetson. Everyone's at their desk, at their carrel. There's the famous Japanese robotic seal. It's a wonderful help to Alzheimer's patients and so on.
Hello.
The Age Lab offers a whole range of products and ideas, but I was there to try a special suit that the lab has made. The suit mimics the physical conditions of aging. Samantha Brady bundled me into it.
So to start the aging process, we're going to put a weighted vest on first.
All right. This is to feel what it would be like to gain. How many pounds is this?
This is 10 pounds, but this is actually not that you're necessarily going to gain weight, but muscle loss is very common.
Feel. So yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Everything at the Age Lab has a name. It's part of its charm. And the suit is called Agnes, which in this amazing, very MIT acronym, stands for Age Gain Now Empathy System. It's a composite snarl of bungee cords and weights and restrictive clothing. It's got limitless amounts of Velcro and a good number of snaps. And it took me a full 15 minutes just to get it on.
All right, so the more muscle loss weights come on now.
Yes. So now we're going to go with the ankle weights.
All right.
So these are about 4 to 5 pounds each.
And they wrap right around.
One of the really startling things the Agnes suit provides are these kinds of numbing Crocs that you put on your feet, which very skillfully imitate the loss of sensory feeling in your foot pads that can cause the slower shuffle many elders walk with.
All right. Let's go to Joe's office. All right. Now I can blame Joe. I may kill Joe. At this point,
Joe Coughlin, who's the creator of this monstrous suit, is the head of the lab.
Wow. Oh, my goodness.
Looking a little different now.
Yeah, I'll say.
So
he's a fellow boomer in significant good health still. I don't know if he's a particularly fast walker, but once I put on the Agnes suit, I did start to notice how
goddamn sprightly he seemed by contrast.
Moving a little slower, perhaps?
Slower, and the really weird thing is that one's gait, it's the interface with the ground. I know that sounds like a weird thing to be troubled by.
Yeah. We also make the mistake quite often that older adults are naturally slower. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're not slower. It's that lack of flexibility and ability to take a wide step that is making them slower.
Right. Well, let's walk a bit, Nick. Okay. Let's do a test. I want to find out what this is like. And oh, my goodness. This is so aggravating. Joe Coughlin springs down the hallway, and I follow, an aging Lear-like figure trudging along behind him. We get to this kind of faculty lounge. This is an area with a coffee machine. It's a very fancy coffee machine. It's got a touch screen where you order the kind of coffee you want. Coughlin wanted me to try working this touch screen on the coffee machine because as the world we're living in becomes increasingly digital, touch screens abound, and they present certain challenges for the aging. Well, look at this. Here's the...
Now, actually, this is a fun thing to think about. So look at the coffee machine we've got here. I want you to navigate that coffee machine to pour yourself a cup of coffee. And by the way, even your hands change as we age. With less moisture, the touch screens are, shall we say, less forgiving.
Oh, is that right? Yep. Yes, I feel that already.
So here's the cup.
Hit small. I'll do regular. Go. Joe Coughlin tells me that the problem isn't just my newly, if artificially, gnarled hands. It's really about the way we design the entire world around us. Trying to grasp a hot beverage in your hand is worrying.
Well, think about this. Now, that cup is thinner because we're trying to save on paper.
Right.
Plastic bottles have gotten thinner because we're trying to be eco-friendly. Ironically, that very thing that is being more environmentally friendly is not very gray-friendly. You've got to squeeze it to get a grip on it. So as a result, you'll often take a bath trying to open up the water, or you may get the hot coffee all over you.
I can feel it. It's really difficult to do that, and it's irksome because you worry, I could spill this. And that would be it.
So one of the things that often comes up with using Agnes with all kinds of companies around the world is that people say, well, why don't you just ask older people? Why don't you just watch? And the answer is we do, and we do watch. But here's the difference. Older folks want to cope. They also don't want to admit, if you will, that they are having difficulty. And the other thing is an engineer, a designer, whatever, will know that that can be fixed easily rather than somebody saying, well, heck, I'm 80 years old. That's what it means to be 80 years old. They're as much a victim of the story as the designer who's designing something they think is old age.
They're trapped with the narrative, too, because they think, oh, well, I guess life is just like this now. 15 years from now, only 15, people of retirement age will outnumber children for the first time in American history. Wearing the Agnes suit makes me realize just how everything in our built environment is designed for the young. That's why Coughlin built the Agnes, the aging suit, so that we can empathize in our lived experience with what it's like to be old. Maybe even more importantly, he also organized a focus group of older people, all aged 85 or above, who come in every month to talk to researchers at the Age Lab about what the lived experience of age is like. Coughlin calls them, charmingly, the lifestyle leaders. My producer, Caroline Lester, went with two of the members on their way to a meeting at MIT.
I'll be right down. I'll buzz you into the lobby.
Jean lives independently in her own apartment. She's lived there for decades, and for the most part, it suits her needs. A few years ago, she fitted her ceilings with these kinds of thin, rectangular boxes that deaden all the ambient noise.
I'm almost 95, few weeks, and I had these put in for soundproofing recently. My hearing is so lousy. I was just surrounded by what they call surround sound.
Jean and her friend John, also a nonagenarian, are part of the Lifestyle Leaders Group at the Age Lab.
There he is. John's a fantastic, accomplished. What are you?
I'm an artisan in wood.
Artisan in wood.
I am an 21-year retired physician that now plays in his workshop with wood.
Now, Gene and John take ride shares to get around most days. But there's an element of anxiety attached to it. One of the positive discoveries that the Age Lab has made is that technologies that seem designed for millennials, like Rent the Runway and Uber, actually work extremely well for older people who need that kind of disposability and efficiency.
Do you want to call Uber?
Yeah, I
can. And I'll call on the way back.
Okay.
And then we go right away out there because they come fast.
But where millennials tend to get extremely irritated if they have to wait more than a couple of minutes for an Uber, for the elderly, a car showing up that quickly in less than 5 minutes, that's the stressful part.
Is this ours?
That's our man.
Our kids don't want us driving anymore. It's dangerous driving in Cambridge. So my kids don't like me driving, but we have no choice. We use Lyft and Uber, but for just little diddly things, it's not worth it. It's simpler to get in the car. And when seniors lose their independence of their cars, it is a major crisis.
I'm at that critical stage. My kids depression. Would like me to stop. I have to renew my license in a few weeks.
What are you going to do?
I'm going to try to pass it. If I pass it, fine. If I don't, I'm a different person. It will be a different life.
We'll get off at that first building.
Do you need a hand?
Thank you. I think I'm all right.
Hello.
We're a little later than I hoped.
Doesn't it start at 12?
Yeah, but everybody's sitting there eating before we get there.
Each meeting has a different topic. This week, the elders were asked to bring in recipes. They broke into focus groups where they talked about how their relationship to food has changed as they've aged.
My name is Gloria Jefferson, and I live in Mattapan.
My name is Bob Horlick.
Joe Coughlin later used some of the information gathered from this meeting to write an article.
John Nelson, I grew up in Princeton, New Jersey. I'm a retired child psychiatrist. I've been retired 21 years.
The discussion lasted about an hour, and then everyone dispersed, many to ride shares. This time, it was Gene's turn to order the Uber.
Is our ride coming?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll come out. You want an arm? Let me carry. You should have a hand free.
Yeah, you're right.
You should always.
I wouldn't mind an arm.
Until midlife, we think of ourselves as growing. Suddenly, the same inexorable passage of time becomes aging. And as 20 minutes in the Agnes suit will remind you, aging is an insult to the human spirit, which is resilient, vibrant, forever 19 years old. Growing is a gentle slope upwards. But aging isn't a gentle slope down. It's a series of lurches. And we just pretend it isn't happening for as long as we can until we lurch to a final end. So the idea, the concept we have of aging is perhaps as damaging as aging itself. Even when we admire an elderly person, we find ourselves speaking to them with a fake ebullience, a strained reassurance. So for my own sake, I wanted to reach out to someone who is a lot older than I am, but to whom I cannot possibly feel a smidgen or a spark of sympathy, much less condescension. And the first person who I thought of who was like that, who refused to be diminished by age, was the great American painter Wayne Thiebaud, who I've known for 40 years. I picked up my phone and called Wayne at his home in Sacramento.
Adam, good to hear your voice again.
Wayne is 98 and still producing terrific work. I wanted to talk to him about how age is affecting his art. Would you say it's true that in your 90s you think more about your early years than about your middle years, more about childhood than about, the long prime of your career?
That seems to be true, and even more so now at, I guess, soon to be 99, I live in a whole alley of remembrances. I've been lately in the last years being very interested in people who paint from memory or use memory in a very productive way.
You've had, like all of us, your share of sadness and grief in life. And yet, whenever we've been together, you seem able to find resources of joy and renewal. I wonder what you do. Is it in your work? Is it in your faith? Is it in life itself that you find that capacity for renewal, even in the face of loss?
It's probably also my Mormon upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think teaching also was a very, very important part of my life. I just really see myself as really an old art teacher.
So teaching and tennis are the two propellants for
Well, we have to make a stretch for the tennis. It's really more hit and giggle today.
But you're still out there.
Wonderful exercise. Yeah. Still get out there two or three times a week.
Suddenly, I felt how wrong it was to ask Wayne about how it felt to be aged. He was old, yes, but he was working, and that meant he was, above all, Wayne. I stopped asking about his age and asked about his art.
Well, I've just finished a series of, over the last 15 or 20 years, of paintings of mountains from memory. And that's going to be a show in November at the Aquavella Gallery.
That's Wayne Thiebaud, the great painter, speaking in 2019. And last week, Wayne turned 100. Happy birthday, Wayne Thiebaud, who's done so many covers for The New Yorker.
Mother Love, which is the idea of trying to paint clowns.
Adam Gopnik is a staff writer at The New Yorker. I'm David Remnick, and you've been listening to The New Yorker Radio Hour. This week, of course, it's Thanksgiving, so let's make it a good one and a safe one. And please know that we at The Radio Hour are always thankful to you. All the best to you and your loved ones. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Morgan Flannery, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.